I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Melissa Morris is the founder of luxury leather goods company Metier. Her unique way of coming to fashion through sculpture and business has created a completely innovative handbag. Looks like you have sunshine in London.
No, it's just probably good lighting. No. Very gray.
Is it? I was in Paris last week, and when I left home, it was like 10 degrees. And when I got to Paris, it was like a vacation. It was 45, you know?
It's been so nice there.
And we've never met. And Melissa, I was trying to think where we even found out about the collection. And I'm thinking it was from a friend of yours in Brentwood. Is that correct? Or how did
it? Yeah, it will be through... I mean, she's really now become a really dear friend, but she is a client that I met actually just by total coincidence. I happened to be in the shop one day and she came in, and her name's Liza. So I think she's, quite close with the team there.
The shop's in London, and she just happened upon it and was buying things and said, this is the best thing I've ever
seen. Well, apparently her husband was in London doing some work and was flying home and read, we were like 6 months old at that time. And I guess there was something in British Airways magazine about this backpack that we have on the men's side. And he ripped it out of the magazine and delivered it to her and was like, I need this bag. So then she ordered it online, and I saw her name, and I'm a big fan of her husband's work. And so I knew who it was, and we got very excited and blah, blah, blah. And then fast forward 6 months later or so, my store manager was off sick. And again, the brand at this point was less than 1 year old. We had four employees. So store manager's off sick, designers coming in, founders coming in for the day. And so I was in the shop, and all of a sudden I look up and they all walk in as a family, and he has a backpack.
His name's Conan O'Brien. And the only reason I say that is because he's also like 6'7".
Yeah.
Right?
He's really tall
and pretty memorable looking.
Yeah. And he said, hi, you don't know me. We're from America. And his family like kind of waved around him. They're all really funny, actually. And he said, you know, I got this backpack and I've nominated myself for the winner of the Best Purchase of the Year award. So we had to come to the home of my backpack to see where it was from. And it was just an incredible coincidence that I was there.
Oh, that's so sweet. And so unusual.
Yeah, it's so nice. And they've just become really good friends, and especially she's become also just a confidant, and just they're incredible. And she's, I can't say enough, but I have to be honest that it's not just me saying it. My clients are the best, the nicest, most interesting people that are doing the most mind-blowing things. And yet they're so humble, interested, impressed by what I do. I think they must be crazy in comparison, but the brand really attracts really fascinating people that are sort of charting their own paths in life. And I feel really lucky because I get really inspired by them.
Tell me where you're from.
So originally I'm from Philadelphia, or just outside. It's sort of a small suburb called the Bain Line, which is just right outside of Philadelphia. My dad's family is from New York, and my mom's family is from the Main Line as well. My parents met studying at the University of Pennsylvania and fell in love and decided to stay in Pennsylvania, which is where I was raised.
What did you love about growing up in outside of Philadelphia? Well, with access to Philadelphia, really, and outside of it.
Because my dad worked in Center City, but my mom had a very serious rule that 6:30 every night without fail, we were having family dinner, sat down at the table, me and my sister and my parents, and then my grandmother as well. So, and that was a thing. And even if my dad had to work after, we were home. So I think having a family home that was so in proximity to Center City was really important. But it's a great city to grow up in, even more so now. I left when I was 18, so it's been more years than I care to admit. But you know, it's the city itself is very much supportive of arts, sports, education, outdoors, family life. So it really is a really nice city to grow up in. But in specific, I think I got very, very, very lucky with the family that I came from, and the way what they valued, which was exactly the sorts of things like family dinner. And every summer we would go somewhere different, as a family, 2 weeks with like always us, always somewhere different, nothing fancy, just with this idea that you're always going to experience some different culture, different food, different way of speaking, being, and finding not only appreciation, but such inspiration from that. That was sort of inherent to how I was brought up.
You have siblings. Where are you in birth order?
I'm the youngest. We're different. I mean, we're typical older, younger sibling. My sister is quieter, and yeah, I'm sort of the loud one that never really did what I was told.
So, and how would you describe yourself as a child in three words?
Oh, gosh. Rebellious, inquisitive, loving.
I read that you grew up in a STEM-oriented household. How did that philosophy play out in your family?
My mom was a mathematician, and she actually was a computer programmer, one of the first female computer programmers. It was actually cool. There was this exhibit in the Tate here in London. My mom came to visit me a few weeks ago, and we went, and it's called Electric Dreams, and it's about the history of computers and these giant art installations inspired by them, but showing all of the old programming and the old language that she knew some of it. It was so wild. But between that and my grandmother was a physicist in World War II.
Wow.
And my dad also was, he sadly passed away when I was a teenager, but he was a genius. So I grew up in a very intellectual household but they made it really relatable and fun through puzzles and games. I ended up getting quizzed on my homework most nights. Ironically, though I love math, horrible at science. I still can't.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
It's not genetic.
No.
So tell me about style. Who influenced your style growing up?
So my mom's mom, her name's Eleanor, or was Eleanor. And yeah, she was everything to me. So because my grandfather passed away when relatively early, and they lived so close to where we grew up, she was over every single night with us. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, so she was like a second mom, really. She originally was from Manhattan and got set up on a blind date with my grandfather, and they fell in love and married. And so she relocated to Philadelphia. But she just, yeah, she had such an elegant style. It was very classic, almost Katharine Hepburn, a little bit of Jackie O. She just always looked totally immaculate. And she also loved to travel the world. She and my grandfather were so interested in exploring all around, you know, not the typical places. And she'd pick up little pieces of jewelry or things and incorporate them into these like incredibly classic, beautifully tailored outfits that it was just, yeah, it was just so flawless.
Did you start to study style and fashion independently, or was that a connection for you with Eleanor?
I always loved style. I mean, always loved reading fashion magazines. Growing up, I think I was always really interested in it. I somehow always gravitated towards it as a way to express myself, sort of testing a little bit who I was and where I fit in and trying to find my own identity. And
was your mom, the mathematician, supportive of that?
Yeah. That, I mean, I'm really lucky. My parents sort of said, you can be anything you want if you try hard and you work hard. And they were so supportive of whoever my sister and I wanted to, you know, how we, yeah, they were completely supportive of our individuality. And I especially, you know, having left home after high school, and I went to university down in Atlanta. So I was already leaving the Northeast, and then I moved to California. back to the Northeast for a few years in New York before I immediately went off to Berlin and now London. And my mom's not happy about it, but she's supportive of it and proud of me.
And so, how did you find your way to sculpture?
I always loved design, and sort of the way my grandmother would explain what real design is and what real consideration is behind something, and the thought around doing something with care. I think that led me into a real obsession with all aspects of design, but I fell in love with interior design and sculptures and specifically chairs because I loved the way a chair is designed. It's a beautiful art piece, it's a sculpture, but it's also for function. And the way you sit in it is, and sort of the shape of the chair is based on what you're doing. So if you're going to relax or you're going to eat or converse or work, or sleep, the chair should be shaped in different ways, and sort of that sculptural consideration should be there. So I fell just completely in love with the idea of sculpture. I think there's such a strong hybrid between architecture and interior design and functional design and the art around it.
You went to Emory in Atlanta and studied art specifically. Did you think you were going to be an artist?
I double majored. I studied sculpture and I studied business. So I guess some of the math good.
The only artist with a business
I
background.
know.
Thank you. Good job. You
Here
did
I am. I
it.
think it probably, I mean, I think it's all actually two sides of the same coin. I like rational thought, and I think that's why I like drawing lines and I like to color inside them. And my color sort of goes out of the line. I look and see, do I need to redraw that line? Or because the color should go out in that direction, or should I bring the color back in? But I like having a reason for what I'm doing. And then I put the reason aside and then allow myself to sort of freely express what that is. And then I see where the two match up and don't, and use them as points to sort of inform where they shape from there. And so I think that's the way I approached why I loved sort of more functional design, like chairs as a sculpture. Didn't really like the idea of something that I felt was superfluous. I wanted it to have rational reason. And I think that's also why I like numbers as well, and sort of the creativity around them of what they. I'm constantly teaching my team, which they look shocked at me how the designer is like getting so excited in the weekly meetings. But I like seeing numbers. I like seeing stats because they're able to give you ideas. I actually walk out with so many ideas of different things I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. And I guess that's why the collections are designed so much with my clients in mind, because I can really understand what they need and what they would want and think about things specifically for them. And it's not something necessarily so esoteric.
And so, how did sculpture and business turn into fashion? How did you seg into wanting to work in the fashion industry?
I have found one thing I wanted to do after school, which was mostly about where I wanted to go. And I found one thing that I wanted to do. Luckily, I had to apply pretty early to get into it, and I got into it, and that was what I did. So the Gap at that time had the Gap in San Francisco had the most incredible executive training program. It was 9 months long, and every 3 months you rotate to a different part of the company. And half of the there's about 20 of us in a class in a, accepted, and half of the time you're shadowing executives, and half of the time you're in a classroom being taught by executives. So everything from presentation skills to working on it as a team to, crafting an assortment plan. And yeah, I just got such a crash course in how a fashion company should work. And it really is exactly that way of having clear structure and goals of how to keep a business alive and growing, but how not to stifle that with these goals and then not allow creativity and free thinking to flow.
Tell me about the 20 people in your class. What were their backgrounds? Had they all come from art, or were they all interested in fashion? And was the point of the program all for you to fold into the Gap,
Yeah.
I guess?
I don't know how many are still at the Gap, but a lot are in sort of running a lot of similar companies. So,
but what were their backgrounds? Were they mostly art majors or what was?
No, I would think most of them were business majors. I can't totally remember. Hmm. Yeah, it was probably a lot of marketing and psychology and customer sort of thinking.
So you finished the program and were you going to maybe stay with The Gap? Were you definitely on your way out?
I loved The Gap and I did. I stayed for another year after. And I think I left because I'm really inquisitive and I'm interested in what's out there. I'm wanting to see everything and experience everything. And there's sort of this insatiable amount of questions I have and wanting to experience things. And I think that's the only reason that I left. Looking back, other than Metier, it was my favorite place I've ever worked. I'm so happy to see that they're finding their way again. It's a great company and had great values. You know, the understanding of how to build a business and a creative business, because I think that's the struggle where a lot of brands and companies struggle with is how can you take something that's inherently creative and shouldn't be reined in? But the fact is that we have bills to pay and salaries to pay and real responsibility. And that responsibility for my team, my suppliers, their families, I mean, that's really heavy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so critical that you are allowing creativity to flourish and the room for ideas to come. But it is also a real business too. And so you have to be able to set parameters and be able to have points of your process to be able to take those parameters and feedback in. It is allowing yourself to have lines drawn for you or with you, and then you draw the color inside them. And that it can't be every minute you're constantly drawing a line and someone's over me and it's like, Matt, you went up colored out of the line. But like you have these clear points where you're reviewing how that comes together. And I think I learned that so well at The Gap, how this is supposed to work. And I think that's why I hope what I'm doing well here with the team at Metier and what we're doing as a business here is really working cross-functionally and understanding whose inputs are when and how, and how we all have to work together as a team, and how to really like data and not, you know, I always tell the team, you know, you could cook the books in any way you want. You could say, oh, that had 100% sell through, but you sold two because you bought two.
Right.
Versus you had a 10% sell through because you've bought 1,000. Which is better, the 100 or the two? So it's sort of being able to enjoy data and question it and look at it as a way to help shape what you're doing and allow you to think outside of the box of how to use it rather than it feeling oppressive or confusing. And I think probably especially in the last 15 years, what I experienced, which was a real shift, because when I came into the industry, e-commerce was not a thing.
Right.
I don't know if you would agree, but there was such a notable shift in the way people were operating their companies when e-commerce came in, because it was almost like you got all of this information, but didn't know how to use it. And it can easily steer you in the wrong direction.
Well, it's also all of this information of people you don't really know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when we used to work with Farfetch and they would say, this is so amazing for you because you're selling things to people all over the world. And I'm like, well, it's not that amazing for me because I have no idea who they are and what they want and why they wanted it and how they're going to use it. And you know, there's really no data. You just told me you sold something to somebody in Saudi Arabia. Okay.
That's great.
You know, yeah. That's so interesting.
Yeah, that was exactly why. I mean, it was, so I launched the brand with a store in London.
Oh, wow. Okay, wait. Can we go back 1 minute, though? So after The Gap, you came to New York and you worked for several brands, Helmut Lang, Belstaff, Armani, and always in New York? Were you always in New York?
Yeah, always in New York.
And always in production?
Design and merchandising. I loved merchandising.
You're really good at it.
Oh.
But I think that's one of the best things about your brand, actually. Well, many, but you do that so, so well.
Thank you.
Which is really interesting to think back about your Gap experience, I think, actually, you know, like when you really look back, like that probably is where you learn the fundamentals.
1,000%. I mean,
yeah,
it's, yeah. And if you walk into any Mickey Drexler run company, you...
So I know you're after the Mickey era, but do you think that a lot of the things that he set into place were still there when you got
oh,
there?
Oh yeah. It wasn't, I'm probably not as young as you think. Yeah. It was just after, without a doubt. It makes sense because it's sort of buying is, you know, how I was taught, a really creative process. You know, I remember one of the first things that I remember one of the first lessons at Gap, they said, right, so you're in the, your department or your business has sold, it's summer or it's whatever time, springtime. And you've just sold a ton of denim jackets that year. And you're looking back now, it's a year later, and you realize the year before you sold a ton of denim jackets. So what do? And someone said, I buy more denim jackets. And they said, wrong. What is that of this year? And so like the fisherman's cardigan or whatever it is, it's what does that do? That denim jacket is that layering piece that you can wear inside and outside. And it's sort of, it's not like you're wearing a coat, but it just, it is that third piece. And what is then that of this year? And I think that sort of creative thinking has been lost.
You know, it's funny because you would always, especially in these big appointments, I've been doing this almost 30 years. So this is many years ago, but thinking about going into, say, a Saint Laurent appointment, and it was my buying team, which is me and one other person. And then you'd walk in with Neiman Marcus, and there would be 15 people. They have Excel spreadsheets, and they'd say, so we sold 4732X9. So we're going to need that again. And we sold it in red. Let's do it in red again. And like, that was the whole appointment. There was zero joy. It was like, it was just a completely different thing. And it was always the saddest thing. But it's weird because it's like, buying is a really hard thing to teach. You know, I mean, you know, innate taste, but, and then numbers and understanding that, but there's something really big in between that can't be taught.
It is a really creative field. It's intuition. It's knowing your customer, knowing people, having an idea that, you know, they're going to love something before they realize that they love it. It is. There is a certain amount that really can't be taught, which is why, it is an art.
So it's interesting. So around this time, you said at its core, I believe design should either solve a problem or improve an experience. And was this around the time when you found that you weren't able to find the bag you wanted, or were these other jobs like boring you? Like what was happening then, and how did this push you towards?
I think there was, you know, at this point, e-commerce, of course, was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and social media was getting bigger and bigger, and not like anything it is today, but I felt that what was unique about a brand and unique about the sorts of products we were putting out, A, we didn't have time to do them well because seasons were getting faster and faster and faster. And even if designs were successful, we needed to make different ones, this time with a fringe or some novelty, or I didn't feel, it felt like an endless cycle, and not in a good way that you felt like you were improving on what you're doing. It just felt like you were just throwing stuff at a wall, and that feel good. And I think also ultimately what I loved about why I fell in love with the industry was, it sounds cheesy, but it's true, it's the teamwork and how everyone works together. And I think that understanding of what all the different departments are meant to do and how they're meant to work together was also getting lost in the shuffle as well. Found a lot of politics. I struggled and I wasn't happy.
And was your last corporate job, was it Belstaff?
Yeah, it was.
Which is kind of interesting too, just because it is sort of a technical product, I guess, right? And
yeah,
and automotive a little.
Yeah, I think at that time I was brought in and they were going through a pretty big rebrand, but it was sort of, is this brand staying with its roots, or is it going to something much more fashion, referencing Phoebe Philo's Celine or Hermès even? Personally, I would always say you have to stick to the core of what the brand always was. And there's evolution, of course, but not such a big drastic change. But regardless of whatever it is, I think the bigger issue was that the entire team wasn't united.
And was Belstaff the first time you'd worked with leather?
Yeah.
That's interesting too.
Yeah.
And so,
But then, yeah.
tell me, so how did it go? How did this go down? I mean, what was your first bag?
So I wanted to leave my job and I wanted to go to culinary school, just try something, have a cafe. And I had a whole vision for what this would be and have a very different life, I guess. I left my job and I traveled a bit. And I realized that sort of as I was traveling, I had my bag, but then a mini bag inside that was like a little pouch that I thought could organize my passport and all of these other things and how clever that would be. And I realized that that became a mini bottomless pit inside of a bottomless pit. And it sort of reminded me of, when I was traveling to the work every day, it's sort of this notion of travel and how I would always be on the subway floor panicking, looking for my subway, missing the train and then missing my meeting or whatever, and how many other women I saw, and we all had the same giant bag, and everyone was doing
With the satellite bag inside of
the
it.
satellite bag, and then your shoes spilling out, and it was just a disaster. And so I realized that sort of when I was actually traveling, that there was this correlation between the way we travel in the modern sense and how the things we need with us, chargers and whatever, all the things that you need with us, it's a lot more complex than when my grandmother was going over there to have a little handbag. It's really was really, really different. And, I realized that the core of what handbag design was sort of made around the time that you had the Kelly bag that was made, or even the Birkin was made as a travel bag.
It's huge.
It was
Yeah,
a bag
huge.
because she wanted something for traveling, which now that would be a tiny thing for traveling. We couldn't deal with it. Sort of
Right.
that consideration to what we actually need didn't evolve.
Living in the suburbs is different than living in New York. I mean, I always say to the salespeople in New York when they're saying this is our number one bag, and I'm like, well, bags for you people are your apartments. Like we have cars, these girls are our women are in their car the whole day going to carpool and picking. So it's a different need. I mean, but generally the idea of really understanding what people's needs are is unusual, I
Yeah.
think. Like it doesn't seem like people really give a lot of thought to that.
Yeah. And it was such a challenge to try to figure out how to create something that was so functional and technical, but still so elegant and beautiful. Because I like sports. I do a lot of yoga and I like to rock climb and I've gotten into surfing, but I'm not sporty. I'm not utilitarian in the way than my aesthetic. I would say it's very similar to my grandmother's, I would hope, but it's much more suited to the 21st century. It's more relaxed. I have a messy bun. Her bun would have been perfect. There was, I think a bit of a difference there. And so the trick was how to create something that was adapted for the way that we live today and also transferable from going to city life to suburban life to world apart overseas and everywhere in between, and allowing yourself to move as seamlessly as possible. The first thing was to figure out how to solve this sort of mini satellite bag and to make it organized. So that was the stowaway, which was one of my first designs.
And so, how many did you produce? And what did you do with them?
Well, so first I needed the stowaway, and then I made the private eye, which was the sort of the everyday bag to go to work with, which had this clipped in, but then when I was done work, I could put it in the coat check, take this out and go have my drink, have a martini. And that was sort of the beginning of what I wanted to do. And then I wanted to create one bag for each for a different need in sort of your journey, and having the stowaway being able to clip between it so that you would never have to look for your essentials and it would always be easy. And I didn't like the idea. We don't do markdowns. We don't do seasons. I like to tell my customers that I like my customers to know that the price that they're paying is the best price that we can give. It's not like you need to wait for it to go on sale. This is what is value versus expensive. You know, it's good value for money. It's an expensive product and it's an investment, but it is, you can know that it is made with such care and quality, and that was really important to me. And so I think in doing that, I needed to have one perfect product for every journey, and that was the way I sort of thought about it. And then the trick was, you know, okay, I know that whenever I'm heading to the passport control, I like everyone around me is freaking out that they've left their passport on the plane, they've lost it. Oh my God. Okay, well, actually, we have a hidden, like a hidden magnet pocket at the top of a seam. I put sort of, I split a seam so you can't see from the outside. I didn't want it to look utilitarian. And also, I wanted it to be a hidden pocket, but you just slip your hand in and you get your passport and you go. Sort of having so much fun thinking through all of the ways you're moving through your day and how to make that as easy as possible. Because that is luxury. Knowing where your things are and not having that stress is a luxury. You wouldn't buy a luxury car if it didn't drive.
So you made these things, and then what?
Yeah, so I was adamant that we launch with a store. Going back to your point around data, I felt that if we couldn't understand who our clients were and meet them and explain to them and see their questions around the concept. I mean, we're the first new luxury leather goods brand. There's been many revitalized heritage brands or leather goods brands that come off the back of a clothing brand, but like a real standalone leather goods, luxury leather goods brand in the space, I knew it was a risk. And, you know, at the time, I got asked, well, why don't we just take over one of the sleeping heritage brands? And then at least you have the name and la, 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 and all of this. And I said, but then I'm stuck with their heritage. So I needed a store to do that, which seemed crazy, especially as we signed the lease on the day of the Brexit vote.
Right.
And e-commerce was booming. Every industry report said retail's dead, blah, blah, blah. But we did it, and it was the best thing we've ever done. And as you're with your stores, you know why. Because if you put proper attention and proper care for your clients, and A, you learn so much, but B, you establish a connection in the universe that explains everything that you stand for without having to speak.
I want you to remind me of that sometimes during the year when I'm stressing out. talk to me a little bit about the process of perfecting the product and the leather. I mean, was that something that did you have bags? I mean, were you a bag person? I'm not really a bag person until I met you.
I got really lucky. It's you're really and you will know this by because you have had such an iconic, successful company that it's a team sport, you know. I come to the table with some real strengths, but it is really is such a team. And so I knew right away I needed to find someone who would be as passionate as I was about what luxury design and craftsmanship could be and was crazy enough to do something like this. And so I found the first person that I was able to hire. His name is Luca Flavi. He's still with me. We're just hitting on our 10-year anniversary in a few months, but he was leading all of the product development and production at a company called Bali. And he comes from his father had a leather goods factory. He sort of comes from a multi-generational background and is just so passionate about the craft. I had heard about him and knew how passionate he was. What I didn't realize was how concerned he was himself about where the industry was going in some ways of mass production and outsourcing production. Yeah, the speed of production and all of the similar things he was also concerned about and was really excited to leave. Not to say it was a comfortable job, and it was, but he had a team of 40 and he was, you know, leading an entire team of a really big company to come be a team of two. Two of us basically spent 3 years, first of all, 6 months of driving around Italy, trying to find and beg people to work with us and take a chance on us. Luckily, we were able to convince slowly people to believe in us. And then we started developing all of our materials and We took 3 years to develop our unique method of crafting because to have something be so functional, there's a reason why a lot of functional products are made from very functional materials and have a lot of seams and a lot of pockets and a lot of things. It's because you have to sort of have a lot of places to sew and keep things strong and to make something that looks seamless and lightweight, but on the inside it's like this whole world is really tricky. And it took us 3 years to figure out how to make something as lightweight and seamless and effortless as possible, but lasting as possible. And luckily, he is maybe even more of a perfectionist than me, which is crazy. And yeah, we just challenge each other all the time.
And then at what point did you know that you were going to be successful?
Still waiting for that minute.
I
Any minute now.
know. Let me know. What's been the most difficult part of your journey over the past 10 years?
I launched in 2017, and then and we went through Brexit shortly after, and then COVID shortly after that. So I think those are just normal macroeconomic things that were really challenging and scary. I'd say the hardest part has been learning to figure out how to teach people and teach your team and coach your team and grow with them and allow the growth to happen and let go, but in the right amounts. So you can't just let go, but you can't stay too much on. No one teaches you how to be a good manager. And I have a lot of ideas around how teams are meant to work together. And as you say, some of these things just can't be taught.
And some of them take many, many years. And you're sort of like, I hate to tell you this, but it's probably going to take you 10 years to learn this. But I would never tell you that because you wouldn't
Right.
stay. Like, you'd be like, nope.
And then sometimes you take it for granted because it's so inherent to you, you don't realize that it's not to others. And we're based in London, but we're very multicultural in the office. And so there's also adapting to all the different cultures. I think people is always the most important and always the most challenging to get right. And I think that has been something I'm really proud of.
What did you wear to prom on the main line in Philadelphia?
Oh, what did I wear? I think I went to a lot of proms.
I love those answers. Which one?
Which one? I wore a Nicole Miller gown, a gown by Nicole
Nice.
Miller. It was now it would actually, now that the 90s are so cool again. That would be cool. Like this black long gown with little, really pretty little floral embroidery, but like not so much, just a little bit, and pink, hot pink velvet straps.
No, ooh, how
And a
pretty.
sweetheart neckline. Yeah, it was really pretty. It
That sounds really pretty. And
wasn't,
shoes,
I
black.
think it was straight across, actually. Yeah.
That sounds really, really pretty. And hair and shoes, jewelry, any
Just
memory?
down.
Handbag.
Yeah, exactly. No, ha yeah, no handbag. There was no portmanteau.
It That's a good one. All
Yeah.
right. I love that.
What did you wear? I want to know what you wore.
I
Not surprised.
went to several also. One I really liked was a Laura Ashley puff sleeve sweetheart that I got in London at the Laura Ashley summer sale,
That's cool.
like a French blue polished cotton. I really like that one. But
You would be so trendy now.
I know. Exactly. But another one I really liked was an Ann Taylor, and it was which was really nice at the time. And it was this super chic, like black to the knee, really slim cocktail dress with a pale, pale pink bodice,
Right.
sort of like empire. I can't really, it was so pretty. And then this is this is your podcast. And then,
But I like this. Maybe we should have a dress side hustle and make 90s inspired prom gown.
But the best part, Melissa, for both dresses actually were these black peau de soie Joan and David shoes with a bow on them. I am older than you. So just, you know, it was really chic at the time. But they were so pretty, and I saved up for years and years to buy them. I did, like, actually years. They had a store near my house, and I would go visit them. And thank you. And grateful to you for creating something so beautiful.
Thank you.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram @WhatWeWorePodcast for additional content and show updates.